This is Elizabeth Fernandez, and Spark Dialogue is currently on break until Season 3 opens on February 6. Until then, enjoy this best-of episode. Today we're talking about how various religious communities are addressing the climate change problem. I talked to leaders from the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim communities. This episode is great because it shows us how environmental issues can bring us together as a larger community. Enjoy this episode, and I'll be back next week with a new episode. Science, technology, society, our lives, philosophy, and religion. This is Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez. Although it's frequently portrayed as such, climate change should not be a political issue. It's a scientific issue, and perhaps equally important, it's a moral and spiritual issue. It's an issue that we will have to work together on, independent of nation, political affiliation, and background. With increasing frequency, we see world religious leaders, religious groups, and individuals taking a stance on climate change, stating that we have to take responsibility for our actions on the environment and offering spiritual guidance in doing so. Today we're talking to three people from three such groups: Sultan Bryce from the Green Muslims, Cassandra Carmichael from the National Religious Partnership for the Environment, and Rabbi Fred Sherlander Dobb from the Coalition of the Environment and Jewish Life. So, everyone, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be here.
Yes, thank you for having us.
So, maybe quickly we can introduce your organizations individually and what your role is within them. So, Sultan, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So, I am the Director of Development with Green Muslims. We are a faith-based organization that's all about Muslims living in the environmental spirit of Islam. We're based in D.C., and currently we're an all-volunteer board. And we're really excited to be in this space. We've been around for about 10 years and got our 501c3 in 2015.
Okay, great. Cassandra, how about you?
Yes, thank you. I'm Cassandra Carmichael. I'm the executive director of the National Religious Partnership for the Environment, which is an alliance of major Judeo-Christian institutions in the United States. And the focus of this partnership is to address environmental issues from a place of faith.
Okay, great. And then Fred?
Hi, so I'm a full-time pulpit rabbi in the Washington, D.C. area, Dedat Shalom in Bethesda, and the past chair of Interfaith Power and Light locally, which helped get the D.C. Green Muslims going. I'm now a member of the board of Cassandra's group and NRPE, and I'm the volunteer chair of the Coalition on the Environment and Jewish Life, which works with the sort of alphabet soup of the national Jewish community agencies to mobilize around green concerns.
Okay. So first of all, how do we know that climate change is something that's really happening? And how do we know that as people, most likely we have a hand in what's happening in our environment today?
Well, you know, there is a overwhelming body of science that you could refer to. Or additionally, you know, look at the real life experiences of people who are in places where we're seeing sort of unprecedented natural disasters or resource constraints that cause humanitarian issues. So, I mean, there's many things that sort of fall under the category of climate change, and that's something that at Green Muslims we try to take a broad view on.
So as our environment is changing, people say, well, the world is getting warmer. But what does this actually mean? Like, what kind of things do we expect from climate change? How about you, Fred? What do you think about that?
So it's often said that we shouldn't frame it as global warming so much as global weirding.
Right.
The warmth is true on average, a degree Celsius already, and the potential to climb catastrophically. And for lots of us, especially in northern latitudes, that sounds good. But
yeah.
In fact, the level of confusion that that sows into what had been semi-predictable patterns over time of climate on which we rely. For example, rainfall patterns, which then drive either successful harvests or droughts. And we're seeing that much more often in some of the poorer and more conflict-ridden parts of the earth, which are among the first to be destabilized by climate change in the extreme. It's also more extreme in certain pockets, the Arctic, for example, with massive dislocation for native peoples, and we're seeing that in many spots. There's a public health concern reaching the level of crisis because just as songbirds arrive earlier and trees bloom earlier, we have new vectors for infectious disease that we hadn't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
This is a social justice issue, a public health issue, a political stability issue, as well as environment and human rights.
Right. In trying to do something about climate change, an important part of this is, of course, the Paris Agreement. And so for people who may not know a lot about the Paris Agreement, Cassandra, do you have a little summary about what exactly that is?
Well, the Paris Agreement is an agreement between countries around the world to address climate change in their own backyards and come together as a global community to try to get global emissions down. And I will say that the Paris Treaty is one mechanism to get us where we're going to go. And there are a multitude of policies and actions that we need to take, and that we don't just need to hinge upon one particular solution as the end-all be-all.
Mm-hmm. The goal is to keep the global temperature rise below 2 degrees Celsius. And a lot of people say, oh, 2 degrees Celsius, that doesn't actually sound like very much if you think about the difference. What does this mean? Why is that 2 degrees number so important?
You know, 2 degrees can mean make it or break it for any specific ecosystem that you might be looking at that's within an affected region.
Yeah, in many places, the rainfall patterns are shifting. Even in some of the biodiversity hotspots, rainforests in the equatorial regions as well. Of course, coral reefs are among the most critical, which are bleaching because of a combination of ocean acidification, which is also being driven by climate change, as well as the rising temperatures themselves. So there's a lot of feedback mechanisms, which is part of why 2 degrees is important. And it's worth noting Paris Agreement strove to sort of give nations extra credit to move toward 1.5 degrees Celsius, because even two, we're playing with fire, literally and figuratively.
You bring up a good point. It's not just temperature. It's also all of these other interconnected things. The environment is a very complex system. How do you think that climate change is also a moral and religious problem?
So I would say that I'm less of an environmental expert and more coming at this from a strong place of faith and listening to what the scientific community is telling us and translating that into how does it relate to our faith. And I think there is a very strong moral component to addressing climate change. And you mentioned there are particular areas that might be feeling climate change more than others. And I would argue that you can't, it's like unraveling one piece, one string in a tapestry. If you pull one string out, it changes the entire picture. And so while there might be some regions that might get hit first and hardest, it has impacts for us as a global community. And in particular, those of us that live on the quote margins, people with less means to adapt, they're going to be hit first and worst. And so for us, from a community of faith, particularly, and I can speak from the Judeo-Christian perspective, is we are asked, called, part of our teachings guide us towards caring for a Christian term, the quote, least of these, those that that do not have the ability necessarily to thrive without some assistance.
Yeah. So a lot of people say, yes, the climate change is affecting the poor more. How is this happening? Maybe not just in our own country, but on the world in general.
So the least among these, the particular concern for those who need the help the most, and let's remind ourselves, the global poor are those who did the least to contribute to this, who can't at least say, I built up the wealth of my household or my society or my bank account because of some of the unintentionally ruinous practices of the last century and a half. These are people who did the least to contribute, are being hurt the most, partly because poor people tend to be disproportionately located in areas, both equatorial regions, coastal areas where sea level rise is a huge issue, and neighborhoods. You know, we saw in Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, why was there a color line and an income line among the primary victims of the hurricane? Because that's the history that we can't ignore, the social, racism, other concerns. We call that environmental justice when we look at the two together. And from a religious perspective, we cannot possibly separate them. The other reason is what we call adaptation, the question of how resilient are people? What kind of networks do they have? What access do they have? And so wealthier people can afford to pay higher food prices in times of famine. They can afford to have a vehicle with gas in it to get away from the coastal area in time of flood or hurricane. Poorer people don't have those advantages. So there is a massive social justice element to the entire climate question.
What do your various holy scriptures say about stewardship to the earth and why it's important to take care of the planet?
In the Quran, it's clear, sort of the dictate that we have as Muslims to care for our environment. And the word that's used is khalifa, that literally translates into steward. So we feel that really at the heart of Islam, there's a dictate for us to care for the earth and to be part of seeing the people who live on the earth too as part and parcel of what we do as Muslims. There's a very clear direction for us in terms of how we do it and in terms of caring for one another and focusing on those who can't necessarily help themselves or who have the least.
And I can talk a little bit from the NRPE perspective, which is Judeo-Christian, but I'll leave it to Fred, who's so eloquent on this topic, to talk more about the Jewish tradition. But NRPE and its partners focus on the stewardship aspect when it comes to environmental concerns, but coupling that with caring for people. So we don't separate the two. You can't care for God's earth without also caring for God's people, and you can't care for God's people without also caring for God's earth. And when we look at scripture from the Christian standpoint, there's a passage in Genesis that talks about tending the garden. Many people know about the story of Noah, where he came in and was asked to save all the animals and put them on the ark two by two. So created sort of another stewardship vehicle, metaphorically. So that's sort of an example of the stewardship, but then that's overlaid and interwoven with the caring for people, the social justice aspect, and in particular, the caring for marginalized communities. And there's a scripture in Matthew that talks about caring for the least of these.
Yeah.
Right. And similarly, theologian Martin Buber, early to mid-20th century, wrote that finally, love of the Creator and love of that which God has created are one and the same. So really echoing what the others have said, that you can't claim to love God. You cannot be in relationship with ultimacy. You cannot be a person of faith and ignore the real cries, the groaning of creation. In Jewish terms, when we address a sort of religion, first we separate law and teaching or legend. And on the legal side, there's profound Jewish tradition about not wasting, called Bal Tashchit, that you can't wantonly destroy anything. Even in the Talmud, they talk about using the best available technology, know what kind of lamp you're burning, because oil or naphtha, you have to do different things based on the fuel to minimize the pollution and the waste. And if we had that already in the year 400, then by 2016, we should be mandating better mileage from our fleet, that sort of a thing. And on the theological side, we talk about creation, revelation, and redemption. So creation is obvious. Stewardship comes directly out of Genesis chapters 1 and 2, where in chapter 2, verse 15, God tells the first human about the relationship to the first ecosystem, which is le'ovda ul'shomra, to serve the land and to guard it. The only thing that we're precluded from right there in the second chapter of our holy book is to let it get worse on our watch. And in that sense, we're collectively falling down. Revelation, of course, is scripture and all of those teachings, and redemption, we look forward to the moment when people don't have the kind of anxieties that they do now. So redemption is the ultimate messianic question for many of us, but in real time, it's redemption from the social ills, it's redemption from the vulnerability, and we've already addressed all of those social justice angles, which are calling out for us to extend our circles of compassion and concern ever wider.
Yeah, well, those are all great examples. And Cassandra, I saw that you wrote something that was a really nice example. You gave the example of Noah and the ark, and God told Noah that he had to build the ark, but he didn't give Noah the ark.
Yeah, I'm a big Noah fan. Fred probably doesn't know this. I'm a big Noah fan and I love that story because there's so much metaphor in it and so much for us to draw from it. And particularly in addition to God did not provide Noah the ark, God also was very clear that it was all the creatures were going to go on the ark, and that Noah was not to determine or put value on one over the other, and that they all went in. And I'm sure that there were some that he didn't want to share space with. And again, it goes back to the same thing about the, when you pull one string out, if you, you know, got rid of all the mosquitoes, which I would probably vote for, I would vote the mosquitoes off the ark. But we don't know what impacts taking one species out has on the rest of the creatures that are in our metaphorical ark now.
Yeah, and I think that the people who are climate change deniers, per se, a lot of them are reluctant to accept climate change because it's scary. It's really scary to think that we're affecting the Earth on this scale. But I think that also by accepting responsibility, that's the first step, and it could be a very positive thing, because then we realize that our actions have consequences, and that we can actually do something.
So empowerment is such a critical question, and hope, of course, is closely related to faith. That's a religious question. It's also a question of the moment. Those of us who wake up in the morning thinking about the future of life on this planet, and particularly those at the margins, this is a very scary time, with questions about whether the U.S. will even continue to uphold the U.N. framework for climate change, the Paris Agreement, etc. But there are many sources of hope from our traditions, and the one that I want to offer that is most compelling and important is to take the long view. We live in a society that is so often driven by quarterly profit reports when it comes to industry and markets, or two-year electoral cycles when it comes to our democracy. But our scriptures speak about the third, fourth, seventh, thousandth generation, which begins to approach not just human time, but geological time or theological time. We need to take the long view. Judaism talks about l'dor v'dor, from generation to generation. And we've been through a lot of challenging four-year cycles in the past. Every year that we delay means more suffering, means more preventable deaths from the ravages of climate change, means more lost species. So there's plenty to mourn, but we can't afford to mourn too much when we also need to organize.
That's right. So working quickly and working now is a good thing. So, Sultan, what do you think that we can do as individuals? A lot of people want to know, like, what can we do right now to make our world a better place and our environment a better place? So do you have any suggestions for these people?
Yeah, and you know, one thing, I think what Fred and Cassandra have both said are so wonderfully about the impact of climate change on our world at large, and sort of talking about the margins and the least as sort of a broader group of people. But I think exactly to double down on that and to say, you know, climate change is a spiritual issue, and it's a theological issue, and it's a scientific issue, but at the heart of it, it's a humanitarian issue. And what we're really concerned about as Muslims, and in the Green Muslim sort of framework, is how is this like affecting our neighbors and people that we live with on a much more specific regional and local scale. So when you ask about what we can do, well, you know, what can you do to support your neighbors who are living with less than you or dealing with issues that you might not have to deal with? So whenever I'm asked that question, so the first thing I think about is, what does someone else have at stake that you might not have? And how can you leverage that power or privilege to make up for that difference? So from a what can we do about it perspective, education is clearly the first step. Our approach at Green Muslims is threefold: education, advocacy, and reflection. So the reflection piece is really important. First, where is it that we're standing as individuals in our assessment of our own effects on the earth, effects on our neighbors? You know, the next is educating. So what is it that you learned about the way you're impacting the earth, and how can you share that with people like you or who are in community with you? And then finally, advocacy, which moves into action, acting on it. So, you know, in the DC area, the DMV area, there's plenty of places to get involved along that sort of that three-tier line. And we, you know, encourage and welcome people to join us in our Green Muslim events and, you know, the great work that other folks on the line are doing.
Mm-hmm. And Cassandra, what do you think about as a globe and as a nation, especially now that we have a new assortment of political leaders from the president down to our congressmen or senators? What do you think that we can do all together?
Well, I think that's a great question. And there's not a one easy answer, because our nation is made up of people and communities and cities and states. It's not just, okay, we need to look at Congress to pass comprehensive climate change legislation, or we need to ensure and encourage and prod President-elect Trump into taking on climate change as a major issue. If any one of those things happened, it wouldn't solve everything. Or we need to push the clean power plan through and make sure that that gets intact. That's not going to solve all the problems. So there needs to be a multi-pronged approach, which also starts in everybody's individual life. And I would say that you can't have one without the other. We need to have individuals and families taking action in their own homes. And I agree about education, but I also think that people need to feel empowered, as Fred was saying, about taking action, and that it doesn't have to be, it's not a prescribed action. I'm not going to sit here, Elizabeth, and tell you what you need to do is you need to drive 20 miles a week and only eat carrots. It's not for me to determine what you're going to do. You need to look at your own life and get in touch with your own higher power and your spiritual nature, and determine what are the things that are feasible for you to do so that you have a reduced carbon footprint and contribute to the overall effort that's underway to really address this. And then, in addition, communities and cities and states need to take on action, and we as people who have a voice in that process need to be speaking up and advocating for climate change solutions and policies at both the local, state, and then the national level. Because as I mentioned earlier, this is not a quick, it's not a quick one easy flip a switch solution. This is that we're all pulling together in the same boat, rowing in the same direction, but we each have our particular piece of the pie, a piece of the oar that we're contributing to the direction of where we're going.
Yeah, I would just add, it's not a question of individual actions or social collective. One drives the other. Even if we did, only ate carrots, or certainly eating lower on the food chain, actually, the less meat we eat, it makes a huge environmental difference, actually. But all of the private virtues that we can do to lower our carbon footprint, they do help, but they help very incrementally. The bigger way that they help is by raising awareness and deepening our own passion. As Sultan said, the reflection side. And you reflect, you take it seriously in your own life, and then you put yourself out there. You make it a priority in your activism, in your philanthropy, in your public education, etc. And eventually, that's how we drive change. The political system is responsive to the passions of people. And when presented with the facts, people get it and understand that this is a top-tier concern that will define the reality for our grandchildren, and all the energy that we put into making the world a better place for those who follow us needs to include climate awareness. We can get there, but it's going to take that combination of personal action to reduce our own footprint and deepen our own passion, and organizing at the collective and political levels.
I think it's nice that when we look at our religious traditions in the lens of climate change, we all have a lot of commonality. We all are seen as stewards of the earth. How do you think that we can all work together as a diverse human family of all different backgrounds, of all nations, religious traditions, to make this world a better place?
I'll give one small and concrete example. Our synagogue helped pioneer with Interfaith Power and Light and the National Wildlife Federation the idea of rewilding little pockets of grass that are anywhere on our church, mosque, ashram, synagogue properties. And when you think about a large metropolitan area like Washington, and you take literally the bird's eye view, then imagine if there were devotees of nature with the passion of theology behind them, who are creating these little pockets of wild, of resilience against a changing climate, and doing so at intervals. I love the image that a hummingbird could have breakfast at synagogue, lunch at church, afternoon tea at the gurdwara, and dinner at the mosque. And that is becoming a reality as we work together locally. The fact that we and people in our communities know each other, and we've had Christian and Muslim groups come to our synagogue to see what EPA Energy Star facility and solar panels and stuff, how that works, and are beginning to replicate that in their own communities. But also environment becomes one of the ways that we can overcome those painful divisions in our society and have people encounter one another and be there then to stand in solidarity with one another when any of us are threatened.
Very well said.
Agreed. You know, specific to what Fred just mentioned, we partner with the EPA, which has a really strong, actually, faith forward program to work with houses of worship or other gathering spaces to help them become more energy efficient through energy audits, things like that. So you said a phrase earlier that I wanted to come back to because it's the best way that I think to define or describe the environment and climate change, which is it's a complex system. And if you really break that down and you think about how complex systems are approached or discussed from a framework perspective, that's really apt. And I think in the best case scenario in terms of working together across all of humankind, you know, where we can double down on the intersections of those complexities, there's often places that have a multitude of benefits. So, you know, there's strong cases for partnership across faith traditions or industry and government or, you know, the academia. There's places where we can sort of benefit from each other if we approach it from a complex systems perspective. So, you know, I think that's one really cool thing about focusing on climate change is there's an ability to really intersect across different communities and groups, however they organize themselves.
And I would definitely, I really like that, not only talking about intersection and partnership, but in some ways, climate change is asking us, calling on us to be in community in a way that we haven't been before, because only at that point will we really be able to, quote, solve the issue of climate change. I think the religious community in general can serve as a model, has the opportunity to serve as a model for both action in their own places of worship and also in how they partner with the rest of the world.
I just want to add the power of addressing this from a religious perspective. You know, science and religion at best go hand in hand. Religion need not, and faith need not be blind. In fact, we want to use all of our senses to celebrate the Creator and creation. So there's something about the power of language and to invite folks to not bifurcate between their religious identity, where they go for worship, if at all, and their identity as people in the world, including as citizens, as voters, as consumers, and to remember the power of using religious language. Sultan just talked about complex systems, which is absolutely true, and we need to honor the complexity. We've talked about ecosystems, which, of course, are a classic example. But there's a really resonant phrase that often comes up in religious environmental work, which is a synonym, but it's to speak of the interdependent web of creation. That is the same thing. But it hits you, as we say in Yiddish, in the kishkes, in the guts. It's much more personal when you can begin to realize that we are part of an interdependent web of creation and not simply in the environment or part of an ecosystem. And in every regard, the power of harnessing faith tradition, resonant language, ancient history, and the clarion moral and spiritual call of all of our faiths to this critical moment in human and even ecological history, there's tremendous peril, but there's also tremendous promise. And it's conversations like this that hopefully drive the latter.
Yeah, I definitely hope so.
And the last thing that I will add is that in addition to everything that Sultan and Fred have said, that the religious community offers something to the rest of the world, in particular the environmental activists and the scientists, that they can't do for themselves in some ways, is that religious community offers stories and metaphors of hope and love. And we recently did a forum where we were talking about endangered species, and we had some folks from the environmental community came and attended. And in some ways, they got more out of that dialogue than some of the people of faith, because they often feel hopeless and that they are fighting an uphill battle and that they're not going to, quote, win. But there's many stories of redemption and hope and change, even just in the Judeo-Christian narrative and all the other traditions. The story of Noah, it's a disastrous flood, and then we're delivered from the flood with Noah's and God's guidance. And then the story, there's all kinds of stories where the impossible becomes possible. People of faith live not just in the place of faith, but also in a place of hope. And that's hope born out of love, love from the Creator. And that's something I think that the faith community can really strongly offer our other partners in this work. And I think Sultan had a great point about that we can be in partnership, and that's something that the faith community can strongly offer.
Yeah, I really hope that that is something that the religious communities can provide everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing I really like what you both said about both the long view and about offering hope, and one of the most powerful ecological principles I ever learned in studying environment is the concept of resilience, and the way it's defined traditionally, you know, by the person who coined the term, Buzz Halling, says, you know, resilience is the ability of a system to maintain a certain set of characteristics after an interruption or after some kind of event of impact. So, you know, we might not know what it is, what characteristics, you know, we as an entire community of Americans or specific different faith traditions that we all agree, I guess we all agree on in terms of the characteristics we want to pull forward. But it's important to know that, you know, resilience can look many ways. And I think if you take the greatest common factor of all of our, of all different traditions, whether it's the ones represented here or beyond, of like a human condition, there are some that we agree on, which are, you know, basic principles and basic resources that we all have access to. So I think there is power in sort of reinforcing these scientific principles and what they can teach us about how our social communities do as well.
Yeah. Well, thank you all so much. I think you offered some really great insights, and hopefully this drives people to move forward and give them hope. So thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcasts. You can find out more about this podcast at sparkdialogue.com, at facebook.com/sparkdialogue, or on Twitter at sparkdialogue. This episode begins season 2 of our podcast series, with a new episode every other week. In 2 weeks, we'll be joined by Dr. Alan Weissenbacher, where we'll talk about neuroscience, addiction, and how you have control over how your brain develops. This is Elizabeth Fernandez, and as always, thanks for listening.